Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Tina Turner's Big Money brand and rights deal. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me, it's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
You're not with me, though, are you? I mean, you're never with me, but you're extra not with me today.
Yeah, usually when we're recording this podcast, there is some mileage between Andy and his microphone and me and my microphone. But this week, the mileage is much more significant because I am currently in Finland at a great event called Music and Media. So I think this is the first time ever that I have tried recording a podcast from my hotel room. Long, 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 long time listeners to Setlist. Those people, and I know there are some of you out there who have listened to Setlist for so long, it wasn't called Setlist when you started tuning into this podcast.
Yeah.
Because we had a name before this. Let's not go into that. But there was a time when I was in Edinburgh at the Edinburgh Festival, and I was recording my side from Edinburgh.
Oh, God.
And I recorded my side over a phone line.
Blank this out.
In a cupboard back to the studio we were then using for the podcast in London. And basically, it was a disaster. The reason why we've deleted all podcasts pre the Setlist rebrand is just to get rid of that one embarrassing podcast. But things have moved on.
I think that one might still be available, actually. But don't go and find it. It's so bad.
Please let it not be in the podcast. Let's hope that somebody somewhere has deleted it. But we're a bit more confident. I'm not on a phone in a cupboard in Edinburgh. I'm on a mic and a laptop in a hotel room in Finland. So we are hoping that this works and that I'm not just a crackly mess throughout the entirety of this podcast. So let's all now, actually, people listening, you already know whether or not it's a crackly mess. But me and Andy are now touching wood that this is going to work. So we'll see how it goes.
Yes, we'll see. I mean, we've chosen this week to use a completely different recording setup for you as well. So, I mean, what could possibly go wrong? Anyway, I'm sure it's all fine. And as ever, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry stories of the last week. A week when Kanye West announced that he is opening a school.
Yeah, Kanye School. That's not what he's calling it, is he?
No, the Donda Academy.
The Donda Academy. Although, beyond its name and that it's going to be some sort of school, we don't really know much more about this project, as far as I'm aware.
No, the website for the academy is accepting admissions. And it says some vague stuff about kind of its ethos, but it doesn't really say anything else. I mean, it would be very bold of you to go to the admissions page on this website and fill out the form with a view to going to this school, because it doesn't tell you what subjects it's going to teach. It doesn't tell you who's going to teach them. It also doesn't even tell you where it is. We only think we know where it is because a local newspaper in California reported last month that Kanye West was looking at the site of a former school to open his own school. But he has not, at the time of recording, said where this school is or really anything about it. So, yeah, although apparently people are signing up to it, I think the plan is, from what we can tell, to go around schools that have really, really good basketball players and get them to transfer to this school. As of this morning, when I last looked, 4 top-level high school basketball players, school and college sports being a much bigger thing in the US than it is, I don't mean anywhere else. The idea of school football being a thing that people cared about in the UK is just laughable. But in the States, it's a big deal. And so, yeah, these 4 top-flight high school basketball players have already committed to transfer to the school. I mean, not just from California, from like all over the states. So clearly the message is getting out to someone.
The other thing he hasn't even said, and we're kind of inferring from those basketball players, is what the age of the students at this school will be. I mean, those are high school age people. Yeah. So presumably we're talking about high school age students. It's not going to be sort of university level. It's not going to be a kindergarten for 5 year olds. It's going to be people in their early teens, I assume. But again,
imagine Kanye West teaching 5 year olds.
But we're inferring this. We don't actually know because, as you say, he isn't saying where this academy is going to be. He isn't saying what it's going to teach. He isn't going to say who the teachers are. And he's not even saying what age his students are going to be. But I'm sure it'll all be fine. And anybody who is a 14 or 15 year old aspiring basketballer come rap fan, maybe you should consider leaving whatever school or college you're at and taking up a whole new education courtesy of Kanye West.
I mean, I don't see any problem with that.
But there is one thing we do know about Kanye's new college. It's pretty much the only thing we know for absolute certain about Kanye's new college. And that is, it's not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, it is not. Because later on, we will be discussing Friendly Fire's anger at one of their songs being used to soundtrack Boris Johnson's arrival on stage at the Conservative Party conference, and why that might have been copyright infringement. But first, Tina Turner has become the latest musician to sell off their rights in a big money deal. In a wide-ranging deal with BMG, she's given up her recordings, songs and brand for a reported $50 million. And like many of the recent big deals with heritage artists, this arrangement is a little bit complicated and it requires you to navigate the differences between copyrights, royalty rights, remuneration rights on the recording side and writer share royalties on the song side.
Yeah, because you said there that with this new deal that Tina Turner's done with BMG, she's giving up recording songs and brand rights under this deal. But what does giving up actually mean? And obviously, there have been so many of these deals over the last 18 months with companies like the Hypnosis Songs Fund and Roundhill, and then Sony, Universal, Warner are starting to get into this as well. There are other new funds popping up all over the place and BMG getting a little bit of a cut of the action, signing up the rights of heritage artists. But whenever these deals are announced, there's usually a little paragraph in the middle of the press release which provides some information about what it is exactly that the company that has bought these rights has actually bought. And I think there are two reasons why those paragraphs goes into these statements. First of all, if it's like a Hypnosis Songs Fund and it's actually an entity listed on a stock exchange and they've got investors, I guess there's probably rules and regulations of being very precise about what it is that you've bought because you wouldn't want to be misleading your investors. So they have a transparency reason for being super upfront about what it is that they have acquired. But also, I think there is the issue of, well, this BMG announcement with Tina Turner was very keen to stress that Warner Music, i.e. not BMG, is still Tina Turner's record label. And I'm assuming that that was that BMG, and particularly Tina Turner's management company, it's not so much a transparency thing, it's just a, we don't want to piss off Warner by making it look like Tina Turner has left Warner Music and moved everything over to BMG, because that is not what has happened. And so they had to put that in the statement, slightly confusingly, we're getting involved in Tina Turner's recordings and her songs and her brand. Oh, but by the way, Warner Music will still be her label.
Yeah, so as we say, this sort of deal does cover a lot of different rights, and that makes it more complicated than a normal record deal or publishing deal or brand deal in this case, because it's all of everything together. So how do we pull apart exactly what BMG has got in this deal?
Yeah, so in order to understand that, well, partly it's dissecting what the press release says and trying to translate it into exactly what has been bought by BMG through this deal. But it also, as you said at the start, requires an understanding of the different rights that artists have, or maybe they don't have. Because I suppose when these heritage artists have been doing these deals, and we know that for various reasons, there are lots of entities out there at the moment that are hoovering up music rights, mainly from big name classic heritage artists. And so whenever these deals are being negotiated, important question is, well, what rights does the artist actually have? So, I mean, let's start with the copyright, which obviously we've talked about endlessly on Setlist. So when artists are creating music, there is copyright in that music. And of course, we always have to make the big distinction between the song rights and the recording rights, because as far as copyright law is concerned, when you write a song, you create a copyright, but when you record a version of that song, you create a separate, distinct copyright. So in the music rights industry, we have both song rights, which we sometimes call publishing rights, and we have the recording rights that we sometimes call master rights. So whenever these deals are being negotiated, one question is, well, is this covering song rights or is it covering recording rights? And whereas traditionally in the music industry, record labels would do deals around an artist's recording rights and music publishers would do a deal around an artist's song rights, a lot of these deals that have been done in the last 18 months actually are covering both song rights and recording rights, although it doesn't necessarily mean that whatever entity is doing the deal is acquiring those rights outright. It doesn't mean that they are necessarily going to become the owner of the song copyright or the recording copyright, because in many cases, heritage artists did deals many years, in many cases, many decades ago, with music publishers around their songs and with record labels around those recordings. And in the 20th century, life of copyright deals were very common on both sides of the business. So lots of artists who did publishing deals in the 20th century, their publisher will control those copyrights for as long as those copyrights exist on the recording side. Record deals, the label will control those recording rights for life of copyright. Now, it may be that an artist or songwriter didn't do a life of copyright deal, and maybe they got the rights back, or maybe they've negotiated the rights back in more recent years, or of course, under US copyright law, there is an opportunity after 35 years, certainly on the song side, possibly on the recording side too, to get the rights back under law. So it might be that the artist and songwriter actually has the copyright in the song and the copyright in the recording to sell because they kept them or they negotiated them back or they got them back in the US under the termination right. However, often artists and songwriters don't have those copyrights to sell, but they can still do a deal. And it looks like from the way BMG talked about this deal that actually, well, certainly on the recording side, if Warner Music is going to continue to be Tina Turner's record company, that basically means that Warner are still in control of the sound recording copyrights. So what else could she sell? Well, when an artist does a deal with a record label, traditionally the label would own the copyright in the sound recording, but the artist would still have a royalty right. Under contract, they would be due a share of any money that comes in from those sound recordings. So the artist has their royalty right, and you can sell your royalty right, even if you are not the copyright owner. So then any royalties that the artist would be due from the label, rather than it going to the artist, it would go to whoever had bought the royalty right. On the recording side, there's also the remuneration right, or the equitable remuneration right, which sits under law. We've talked about that quite a lot on the podcast. So when music gets played on the radio or in public, under law, artists are due payment through the collective licensing system. That's the remuneration right, or it's sometimes referred to as the neighboring right. And the artist has that right, and they can, in essence, allow somebody else to take control of that revenue stream in return for some upfront advance or investment. So on the recording side, you may not own the copyright in the recording, but you might have royalty rights. You'll certainly have remuneration rights, and you can do a deal around them. Meanwhile, on the publishing side, even if you don't own the copyright in your songs, you still have what we often refer to as the writer's share. And generally speaking, it does differ a little from country to country, but generally speaking, what happens with the song rights is, even where a publisher takes ownership of the copyright in the song, even if they take ownership for life of copyright, when performing rights money, so that's money from radio and TV, and when music gets performed live, and when recordings of a song get played in public, all of that money, the performing rights income, which again usually flows through the collective licensing system, the writer will usually get at least half of that money directly. And that's often referred to as the writer's share of performing rights income. That's not because of copyright law, like it is on the recording side. It's just the way the music industry has set it up. Now, quite how that works differs around the world, but it means that even if a songwriter does not own the copyright in their songs, because they allowed a publisher to take ownership of those rights many years or decades ago, they probably still have the writer's share of performing rights income. So all of those things were name checked in this deal. BMG talked about getting involved in Tina Turner's artist share on her recording, so that will be her royalty right. They talked about neighboring rights, so that will be the money that comes in for Tina Turner through the collective licensing system. They talked about writer's share on the publishing side. So it does seem like a lot of this deal is not actually BMG acquiring the copyrights in the recordings or the songs, but Tina Turner's share, her revenue from the recordings and the songs. So it seems like that is mainly what they're getting in this deal, as well as some stuff around brands and trademarks and likeness. So every deal that's been done in this space, all those massive deals over the last 18 months, if you go back and look at the press release, you'll probably see somewhere it does talk about neighboring rights, artist share, writer's share, or maybe acquiring copyrights outright. And every deal that's been done is a little bit different. And that's our understanding of the Tina Turner deal.
Yes. So in this announcement, what BMG said was that Warner Music will still be Tina Turner's record label, but BMG will get involved in her recording royalties, both from her past record contracts and her performer equitable remuneration rights. And then the deal will also cover the writer's share of her songs catalogue, plus the rights in her name, image and likeness. So that's what makes this different from other deals like this, in that it covers, I mean, a wider range of rights, doesn't it? So it's got her, some of her recording rights, some of her song rights, but also her face and her name, which artists do give up in deals. But I don't think we've seen any of these big deals in the last 18 months that we were talking about that have given up so much in one big block.
Yeah, you're right. Most of the headline grabbing deals to date have mainly been around the more traditional music rights. So the copyright and the songs and the recordings or any other royalty and remuneration rights that spin off. Obviously, yeah, as you say, artists have other intellectual property as well around their brand, their trademark, their likeness. I think was there a Beach Boys deal that was done with that new entity set up by Irving Azoff, which actually they were leading with the trademark side of the deal. So it seemed like that their interest on the song and the recordings was relatively low because obviously the Beach Boys have already got labels and publishers and they were very much leading on the trademark element. But it is true that most of the headline grabbing deals that we've seen in the last 18 months haven't necessarily had the trademarks and the brands as part of it. But I think we are probably going to start to see that happening more. And I guess where you have an artist that doesn't really control many of the copyrights anymore, there may well be an element of, well, if I want to command a really, really, really big upfront check and I can't sell you the actual copyright of my songs and recordings because I don't own them, yes, you can have my remuneration rights, my royalty rights, my writer's share. What else can I give you to get as big an upfront advance check as possible? Well, what about my brand? What about my trademarks? What about my likeness? Maybe we can bundle that in the deal. So maybe that's why it was part of this deal. I don't know. But as these heritage artist deals continue to be done, and I think we're going to see more of these for a while yet, we may well start to see the trademark brand bit becoming much more commonly part of these arrangements.
One of the big questions that's asked whenever one of these deals is done is how will they ever make that money back? BMG and Tina Turner have not confirmed that the amount was $50 million, but that's what's widely being put around, $50 million. How are they going to make that money back, particularly when we don't even know if BMG have actually got any copyrights as part of this deal?
Yeah, and I remember last year when Hypnosis had done one of their big deals, I forget which one it was, and I did an interview for a BBC business program about the fact that all these deals were happening. And they asked an interesting question, bearing in mind that that's when the whole parliamentary inquiry into streaming was also getting quite a lot of headlines. And so their question was, well, it seems a bit weird that there seem to be two narratives coming out of the music industry at the moment. One is that streaming doesn't work and nobody's making any money. And the other is that the big music companies and investors in the city are all spending tens of millions of pounds acquiring music rights. So what's going on was the question. But I suppose for the buyers of these rights, I mean, think about Tina Turner, there'll be two things. First of all, Tina Turner's got some classic hits in her catalogue, which are just constantly making money. They're being streamed, they're being played on the radio, they're being used in TV shows. So you're assured a certain amount of money is going to come in from that catalogue, whatever happens. And even if you're only getting a royalty share or a remuneration share or the writer's share, there's still decent money coming in. I suppose it's interesting with the Tina Turner deal, a lot of these megabucks deals that have been done have been more around the song rights than the recording rights. Whereas an artist like Tina Turner, although she has written a lot of songs over her career, in some ways she's a bigger recording artist than songwriter. I mean, a lot of her biggest hits as a recording artist, she didn't actually write the songs. So almost you want to be involved in the recordings. But my point is, with an artist like Tina Turner, that music is getting used. So even if you're only getting a slice of the money because it's a royalty right, not a copyright, then there's going to be a chunk of money coming in every year. If you're an optimist and you think that the growth we've seen in the music rights business in the last 5 years on the back of the streaming boom is just going to continue for at least the next decade, so actually whatever it is you're making today from Tina Turner's music, every year over the next 10 years, more money is going to start coming in, and then we start to make our investment back. Plus, I imagine BMG may be thinking, even though they're not necessarily going to be Tina Turner's actual active label, and they're not necessarily going to be the publisher of the work, now they have a vested interest in Tina Turner. Maybe they'll be doing stuff behind the scenes that gets more sync deals, or gets her music being used in more places, or BMG have done some interesting stuff in the last couple of years around making documentaries and publishing books and sort of big premium box set stuff. So maybe they're thinking, not only does Tina Turner's music make money, even if we sit back and do nothing, and we hope that the value of that's going to increase every year as the streaming boom continues, maybe they're thinking, particularly by having participation in her brand and her likeness, that they're going to do some documentaries or some other projects around the Tina Turner brand, which A, will make money in their own right, and BMG get to participate in that through this deal. Plus, the knock-on effect is that her music will be streamed more, it'll be synced more, and even though they don't own the copyrights in a lot of that, they're getting their share of the money, so they're easily going to make their supposedly $50 million back and a profit down the line. But who knows what maths they've done behind the scenes and to what extent all of the big music companies and the sort of the newer players in this market are just trying to do deals with as many big name headline grabbing artists as possible just to look like they're in the business and they're doing well. Who knows? We will see, I guess.
So whatever it is they're going to do, BMG CEO Hartley Masuk seemed pretty excited about it. He said, Tina Turner's musical journey has inspired hundreds of millions of people around the world and continues to reach new audiences. We are honoured to take on the job of managing Tina Turner's musical and commercial interests. It is a responsibility we take seriously and will pursue diligently. She is truly and simply the best.
Yeah, we see what he did at the end of the quote there. There might be some people out there who still think of Bonnie Tyler as having sung Simply the Best. I think her version was first. So maybe some people are now thinking they've done a big $50 million deal with Bonnie Tyler. I don't know. But it is Tina Turner, and I'm sure it will be Simply the Best. I'm sure he's right. What could possibly go wrong?
Maybe you've just uncovered a little hint about what their next deal's going to be.
Well, we look forward to reading about that and discussing it here on Setlist.
And finally, on this episode of Setlist, friendly fires last week hit out at British Prime Minister Boris Johnson after he walked onto the stage at the Conservative Party's annual conference to the sound of their song, Blue Cassette. We do not endorse the Conservative Party's use of our track, Blue Cassette, said the band. Our permission was not sought, and we have asked our management to make sure it isn't used again. If we'd intended them to use it, we'd have named the track Blue Bunch of Corrupt Wankers.
Now, of course, regular CMU readers and Setlist listeners will know this is basically an annual event in the British political calendar. Didn't happen last year because of COVID, but every autumn we have these party conferences where each political party does a big conference where they all spend several days in a British city or sometimes at the seaside, all talking about how brilliant they are. And it's generally the Conservative Party conference where this happens. Seemingly, artists are less annoyed if the Labour Party uses their music at their event. But every year at the Conservative Party conference, music gets used. And the thing that generally gets people annoyed, because it's the one bit of the party conference that people who are not members of a political party actually pay attention to, is that towards the end of the event, the leader of the party, so obviously for the Conservative Party at the moment, that's also the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, gets up on stage and spouts a load of nonsense for a short time. And usually there'll be music as they walk on stage. And it's the artist behind that music who gets pissed off. And so, whereas in the US, obviously, when Donald Trump was campaigning to be president and during his presidency, this just became a recurring event because Donald Trump did those ridiculous rallies all the time, and he would use artist music, and his artists would get annoyed that their music was being used at a Donald Trump event. Here in the UK, it tends to be at this time of year when we have these party conferences, whichever track the Conservative Party decides that their leader should walk out onto, that's the artist who then gets pissed off and posts the customary message to social media saying, I did not endorse that. I did not approve that. I'm angry. I hate this party. I hate this person. I'm really annoyed they use my music. And so this year, it was Friendly Fires who enjoyed the honour of being the very pissed off about a Tory using their music thing.
Now, this is the point where we would usually say, because as you say, this is the story that comes up frequently, that there's very little musicians can do about having their music played at events like this. You know, we'd usually say the use of music at these events is covered by the blanket licenses held by the venues they take place in and of the broadcasters who ensure that those speeches are then seen by a wide audience. But it turns out we've been wrong about that.
Yeah, not completely wrong, but arguably fundamentally wrong. shall I explain how we can be not completely wrong, but fundamentally wrong?
I think you're going to have to, yeah.
It is true that the buildings, the venues, the hotels, the conference centres that are used by the political parties in the UK for these events, they will have these blanket licences from PPL covering recordings, PRS covering songs. And under those licences, they can use all of the music represented by the societies, which is most recordings and most songs. And for most of the event, that is true. So when there's music just playing behind the scenes at the various places where people hang out and where they will have their stalls and at fringe events and at, every Conservative Party event, there's always then footage in the evening, isn't there, of them having a disco or doing karaoke and it being funny that sort of stuffy old Conservatives in suits are singing to Tina Turner, Simply the Best, or whatever it is. All of that use of music at the parties, at the networking, in the trade fair stall, at the fringe, all of that, we are correct, will be covered by the PRS and PPL licenses of the venues used by the party conferences. But what we have now discovered, because we decided when Friendly Fires got angry, maybe we should dig a little bit deeper on this. And what we have discovered is that in the license being used by these venues, and therefore by the parties doing these conferences, is a little known exclusion.
Yeah, so these days, the UK's two collecting societies, PPL on the recording side and PRS for Music on the song side, issue a joint license called the Music License, which means that licensees, so anyone who wants to play music in a public place, only has to get that one license to have all the rights covered. They don't have to go and do two different deals. It's a streamlining of things. It makes things easier. But there is an exclusion in that license, as you say, which prohibits the playing or performance of music as an introduction to, during, or otherwise closely connected with the presentation of any political announcement, including keynote speeches during political party conferences and campaigns, unless the organisers of that event have obtained in advance the written permission of all relevant rights holders.
Yeah, so that's actually a very important, albeit seemingly not very well known, exclusion in the PPL PRS public performance license. So as I say, pretty much all of the use of music at the Conservative Party conference, which took place last week in Manchester, most of it is covered. But where you have a big political announcement, or it explicitly says the big keynote sessions at a party conference, actually you can't use any song or any recording under the music license. You have to get specific permission from the rights holders. So in the case of the Friendly Fires track, remember the song and the recording are separate. I think on the song side, the rights holder would technically actually still be PRS, because PRS actually owns the performing rights in its members' songs. But the point is, although it would still be PRS, it isn't just covered by the PRS blanket. You would have to go to PRS and get specific permission to use the song in that scenario. Meanwhile, on the recording side, the rights holder is the label. And the Friendly Fires album that the track Blue Cassette appeared on was released by XL Recordings, which is part of the Beggars Group. So therefore, in order to use this recording, under a strict reading of the rules of this exclusion, you'd have to go to PRS and to Beggars XL to get specific permission to use the recording.
Now, we went to Beggars and asked if they'd granted a license for this. And here's the thing, they hadn't. No permission, as far as we can tell, had been sought to use the track on the recording side. And that would mean they've not fulfilled the necessary written permission part of the license agreement.
Now, we've not heard back from PRS as to whether or not they granted specific approval for this usage. They have confirmed that the exclusion in the main license exists, as have PPL, but they haven't specifically talked about what happened here. We've also reached out to the Conservative Party to ask, well, did you ask anybody for permission? Is there some third party that you thought was in a position to clear this? Or were you operating under the assumption that you were covered under the PPL PRS blanket, like all of the other music used at your event, when in fact, because of this exclusion, music for the big announcements, and I mean specifically, it says it in the license, Boris Johnson's keynote interview was not covered. We have yet to hear back from the Conservative Party, so keep an eye on the CMU Daily. We will ask again, if they don't get back to us, maybe we'll just go to 10 Downing Street and ask Boris Johnson himself whether or not they sought permission to use this track. Did they know they had to? And I mean, you could say, well, hang on a second. If this is a little known exclusion in the license and CMU didn't even know about it because...
And CMU are very well informed.
Normally we're on it when it comes to all copyright things. It's just this one little clause in the license that we hadn't actually been made aware of. But we are told on the grapevine that this has come up before, because as I say, it comes up every year when a Conservative leader uses a track. And we've heard on the grapevine that a couple of years ago, UK Music, which obviously is the trade body for the wider music industry, the trade body of trade bodies, which often leads when it comes to talking to the political community about music industry stuff. Apparently, we are told, wrote to the leaders of the party, the chair of the party, so not Boris Johnson, the Conservative Party, because obviously the parties have their leaders, but they also have a chair. So they wrote to the chairs of the political parties, drawing their attention to this exclusion. So, interesting question. Did that memo get lost? I mean, obviously, during the whole Brexit transition period, people were constantly changing jobs. Do you remember that period where every minister was changing pretty much every month? So maybe the memo got lost in all of that chaos, or maybe they just don't care. We don't know. But it turns out that they should have got permission to use the track for Boris Johnson to walk on. I think it's pretty clear that they wouldn't have got permission. But I mean, technically, by not getting permission, by not noticing the exclusion of the license. Now, you might also say, well, hang on a second. It's not even their license, because, of course, the license most likely belongs to the venue rather than the event organizer, assuming the venue is licensed. So you could say, well, it's not even their license. But you could say, but under copyright law, if you're going to make use of music, it's your job to ensure that you are licensed. And if you think you can use somebody else's license, you're already covered, well, you should do your due diligence. You should go and double check that that's definitely true. Because, I mean, think of all those brands, particularly startup brands, who have been putting videos up on Instagram and TikTok, assuming that because Instagram and TikTok has a license with the music industry, with record companies and publishers and societies, it must be fine. But actually, if you go and actually read the terms of those licenses, it only covers user-generated content, which is why we're starting to see brands who keep putting unclear music into their videos up on the social platforms getting sued for copyright infringement. So even if you're piggybacking on somebody else's license, it's your job to do your due diligence and check that you are actually covered by that license. So who knows what is going on here? But maybe if we talk about this a bit more, and if people in the music community talk about this a bit more, the message will get out there for party political chairs and leaders and people that most of the music you use at your events is probably covered by a PPL PRS license, but not all of it. So next year, go and get permission. And if Boris Johnson is still leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister in a year's time, well, I mean, I think they're probably going to have to commission something original, aren't they? I can't believe there are... I mean, even those artists who slightly lean to the right politically would probably be nervous of having a formal association with Boris Johnson as he goes on stage to spout all his bullshit.
Gary Barlow could play him on. I'm sure he'd do it.
Maybe he could compose something original and play it on the piano as Boris Johnson.
I'll write some in.
Walks on the stage for a fee, presumably.
Oh yeah, yeah. And it might not be complimentary, but they're not going to have a lot of choices. So take it or leave it.
So we always say at the end of stories on the podcast, it will be interesting to see, but three, it will be interesting to see here, which is one, what will the Conservative Party say? Did they even attempt to get permission to use this track? Secondly, if the message gets out there that actually, do you know what? There's an exclusion on the public performance license that people didn't really know about. Will everyone get the message and start asking for permission to use music in big political moments in the future? And three, if that does happen, who will allow the Conservative Party and Boris Johnson to use their music at future party conferences?
As we say, yeah, still some questions to be answered there. We wanted to get this all down in the podcast while it was still fresh, and that's why we don't have all of those answers currently. But if we get them, we'll come back to them in next week's podcast. Or if you want to get them hot off the press, you should sign up for the CMU Daily. Go to completemusicupdate.com/daily to sign up for our daily music industry newsletter. And yeah, that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. You can find links to everything we've discussed on this episode of the show in the show notes, which you'll find in your podcast player right now, or at setlistpodcast.com. Remember to subscribe, rate and review the show. You can email us about anything. If you're Boris Johnson and you want to plead innocence, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moult and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.